So, as usual, we will begin by chanting together all the verses of the fifth chapter. So kindly open your books to chapter 5, Hare Krishna. So in our discussion on Karma Yoga, action in Krishna consciousness, we have discussed the first 7 verses. As we have seen earlier, from text 7 to 12, Lord Krishna is discussing how to perform Nishkam Karma Yoga. Nishkam Karma Yoga is that performance of prescribed duty which is performed only for the service and pleasure of the Lord, and where there is no attachment to the fruits of one's action. Lord Krishna has earlier on distinguished between jnana or ajnani, or the path of jnana yoga, and the path of nishkama karma yoga. He has also especially outlined that if someone following the path of jnana yoga, he takes to the order of sannyas without the requisite purification of heart, then it leads to misery. It is better for such a jnana yogi to perform nishkama karma yoga till his heart is purified. Then when such knowledge has been acquired, then he can take sannyas. A real jnani who follows the path of jnana yoga is in that situation not affected by the performance of karma. We have also seen that better than a jnana yogi is a bhakta or a devotee of the Lord, because it doesn't matter what situation the devotee is in, he or she will simply serve the Supreme Lord. We saw that there are 2 kinds of sannyasis. One are the Mayavadi sannyasis, those who believe that the Lord is impersonal, who do not believe that God has a form, who worship the Lord only with the ultimate objective of becoming one with God, of unity with God. They do not see that they have a distinct identity of their own as eternal spirit souls, the Jivatma. So they want to extinguish that individuality by merging into the impersonal aspect of the Supreme, which is called the Brahma Jyoti. And the second are the Vaishnavas, or the devotees of Lord Krishna, who, although performing devotional service, do not have to perform such austerities as the jnanis have to perform. Not only are the jnanis bereft of the ultimate goal that is achieved by the devotees of the Lord, but also their path is extremely difficult. We saw last time that when a jnana yogi accepts his renounced order, then in the beginning and all through the execution of his austerities, celibacy and studies, it is very difficult. But for a devotee of the Lord, whether a sannyasi or not a sannyasi, the path, although relatively difficult, but still it is very easy. Because here one is not required to perform extreme austerities. One is not required to simply juggle with Sanskrit grammar and words, but rather one is engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. And that is a sublime act of purification to lift one's consciousness up. We saw that there are 3 kinds of sannyasis who are engaged even in devotional service. We saw the Yoga Yukta last time. The first is a Vishuddhatma who has purified intelligence. The second is a Vijitatma who has a purified mind. And the third is a Jitendriya, who has controlled his senses. So in superior order of superior importance, these three have been outlined. And now in text 8 and 9, Lord Krishna is going to describe in what way this Jitendriya actually works. How a person who is situated in spiritual knowledge of his own identity as a spirit soul, of his own identity as being separate from this body, how does such a person work in this world? How can spiritual knowledge be expressed through our work? This knowledge allows us to remain aloof from the body even as we work. So let us recite texts 8 and 9. It's a very interesting verse because it shows us that a person who is really situated on the spiritual platform doesn't understand how his particular body is functioning, how his bodily activities are actually going on, because he identifies only with the soul and he understands that actually speaking he has nothing to do with the body. He is simply residing there. So kindly repeat after me. Naiva kinchit karomi iti. Yukto manye tatvavet. Pashyan shrinvan sprishan jigran. Ashnan gachan svapan shvasan. Pralapan visrijan grinan. Unmishan nimishan api. Indriyani indriyartheshu. Vartanta iti dharayan. Naiva kinchit karomi iti. Yukto manyeta tatvavet. Pashyan shrinvan sprishan jigran. Ashnan gachan svapan shvasan. Pralapan visrijan grinan. Unmishan nimishan api. Indriyani indriyartheshu. Vartanta iti dharayan. A person in the divine consciousness, although engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, sleeping and breathing, always knows within himself that he actually does nothing at all. Because while speaking, evacuating, receiving, or opening or closing his eyes, he always knows that only the material senses are engaged with their objects and that he is aloof from them. Kindly repeat. A person cause while... So here is a description of the state of mind of a person who has actually realized himself. Self-realization means to know that I am the Atma, the eternal soul, that I have nothing to do with this material body, which is temporary, which is an abode of suffering, and which actually is simply a vehicle for the soul. As we have seen many times in our classes, and as you have read many times in the books, the body is always dead. The body is simply a lump of dead matter that is activated due to the presence of the spiritual spark, the Atma, that resides within the body. While the Atma is within the body, the body performs many functions. some of which have been listed here in this verse. Eating, sleeping, talking, walking, so many things that we do in our daily life. All these things are the activities of the body being performed simply because the Atma is there within. When the Atma leaves the body, that is after death, then although the elements of the body, the chemicals, the organs, everything is still there within the body, but the body cannot function. It cannot perform these activities. The body, therefore, is called jada, unconscious. It is not conscious. The soul possesses the property of consciousness, and the soul has a capacity to impart that consciousness to the body. So then it appears that the body has become conscious, but actually the body is never conscious. The body is always dead matter, simply because of the reflected consciousness of the true, of the real soul within. The body can manifest that consciousness externally and also internally for the purposes of so many other functions that are performed, like digestion and so on. In the Srimad Bhagavatam and also in the other scriptures, and to a brief extent in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a wonderful analysis of what this material world is made up of. The very word material world indicates that it is made up of material things, of matter. Otherwise we would have called it spiritual world. Because there is matter, we call it material world. So this material world is composed of 24 elements. The science or the body of knowledge where the various elements that comprise and constitute this universe are studied is called Sankhya. Sankhya comes from the word Sankhya, or counting, number. So it is the analytical study of this universe, trying to understand how the creation of the universe has taken place, trying to understand how the different elements were created, how they were combined together, in what kind of atmosphere they came, and how the process of sustenance of the universe is going on, how the universe will be destroyed eventually, only to be manifest again after a certain period. Very, very interesting how the time factor acts upon this universe and various phenomena take place automatically, so it appears. So in this way, these 24 elements have been described. So what are these 24 elements of which the whole universe is constituted? First of all, you are all familiar with the Pancha Mahabhuta. Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhumira Panala Vayu Kam Mano Buddhirevacha Ahamkar Iti Yamme Bhinna Prakritir Ashtadha. Lord Krishna says that there are five gross elements that are there everywhere, all pervading in nature. Earth, water, fire, air and ether, which represent respectively the principles of solidity, liquidity, gaseousness, and heat or radiation, and space. So these five are called the gross elements, the Pancha Mahabhuta. And each of these five elements is successively subtler than the previous one. So therefore, earth is the grossest substance. Then comes water, then fire, then air, ether, and so on. So the first five of these 24 is the Pancha Mahabhuta. Then there are the three sukshma or subtle parts which are found everywhere, particularly in all living entities. That is the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. The mind is a reservoir of our desires. For millions of lifetimes, whatever desires we have had, whatever impressions that we have acquired in our day-to-day experience in this world, are all imprinted upon the consciousness. And these impressions are stored within the mind, and they give rise to a variety of desires which come up from time to time in our heart. The intelligence is a faculty of discrimination, where we distinguish between one thing and another, between good and bad. And finally, there is a false ego. The false ego is what makes the soul identify itself with the body. The soul is not the body, but due to false identification coming under the illusion of matter, the soul identifies itself with the body. Krishna also explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Aparyam itasthanyam prakritim vidhime param jiva bhuta mahabaho dhare yayadam dharyate jagat. My dear Arjuna, I have explained to you these eight elements, the five gross and the three subtle elements that are there everywhere in nature. But this is the apara shakti. This nature is the inferior nature. There are two words, apara and para. Apara means inferior, para means superior. So what I have described to you, O Arjuna, is the apara shakti. But there is another prakriti, anyam prakriti, and that is called my para prakriti, my superior energy. And what is that superior energy? Jiva bhuta mahabaho. It is a soul. The atmas are the spiritual energy that are also there in this material world. They are the only things which are spiritual. Otherwise, everything else is material. Yaya idam dharyate jagat. So the souls are trying to exploit the resources of material nature, trying to enjoy this material world. And because of that, although the soul is superior to the material energy, because it is very tiny, it gets influenced by the matter around it. And therefore, it comes under illusion. It forgets its own spiritual and transcendental nature. It starts imagining itself to be what it is not. It starts identifying itself with the body. And therefore, in this world, every living entity thinks that I am this body. Whether it's an ant, or a cat, or a dog, or a human being, a king, or a pauper, everyone is identifying himself or herself with the body, with this material body. That is called false ego. And this is because of the influence of the illusory power of the material energy. Although matter is very strong, is dull by nature, but it has a power to put the tiny soul under illusion, under forgetfulness. So by the practice of self-realization, when the soul understands that I am not this body, I have nothing to do with this body, which is only a vehicle for me, I am the pure spiritual soul, then he comes out of the clutches of the illusory power of matter. And then he is situated or re-established in his original spiritual position, and this is called mukti or liberation. Muktir hitva nitharupam swarupena vivasthitihi. So to be situated in our swarupa, our constitutional position, is called mukti. So long as we are not on the liberated platform, we are under the clutches of this ahankar or false ego, which makes us identify ourselves with this body. So then, now we have covered eight items. We have the Pancha Mahabhuta, and we have the three elements which are subtle, sukshma, but they are also part of this material body. The mind, intelligence and ego are also part of this body, although they are very subtle. Then we have the five jnanendriyas, those senses by which one acquires knowledge in this world. How does one acquire information of things around us? By our senses. Our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, and our skin. By these organs, which are inputs to the mind, we acquire information about the outside world. We receive data, and then we analyze it in our mind. So these are called the jnanendriyas. Then there are five karmendriyas. Five indriyas or senses by which one performs actions in this world. It is not sufficient to acquire knowledge of things around us, but one also desires to act in this world. So one acts with the help of the karmendriyas. So what are the karmendriyas? Five in number. Our hands, our legs, our voice. Because we also act with our voice, we can accomplish many things with our voice. In fact, too much in this world. So the voice is the third, then the anus and the genitals. So these are the five karmendriyas, organs by which one acts in this world. So how many is that now? 5 and 5, 10, 15 and 3, 18. Then there are five tanmatras or sense objects. That means those objects which our senses are seeking out. Those objects in which we seek some pleasure or enjoyment. What are the things around us that we would like to enjoy? What do the eyes like to enjoy? The eyes like to enjoy form. The eye always wants to see some beautiful form. Then the ear. What is the ear seeking out? The ear is seeking to hear some very pleasant melodious sounds, music and such like. What is the tongue always hankering to do? To taste very palatable dishes. What is the skin always seeking to do? To touch very soft or nice objects. What is the nose seeking to do? To smell very nice and fragrant substances. In this way, the five organs, the Gyanendriyas, are always seeking out some objects in the world around by which it can be gratified. The eye becomes gratified by seeing a beautiful form. The eye, the ear becomes gratified by hearing a melodious sound. So this process is called sense gratification. The process of obtaining worldly pleasure. So when one hears some nice sound, then the mind analyzes it. Oh, it is very bad sound. He is singing very badly. Oh, very beautiful. He is singing so nicely. So the sensations of pleasant or unpleasant are perceived in the mind. The mind accepts or rejects. Oh, this bad singing, I don't want to hear it. Very nice singing, I want to hear more and more of it. Sankalpa vikalpa manaha. So the duty of the mind, or not the duty, but the activity of the mind, is it is always accepting and rejecting. And the mind is very fickle, because what appears pleasant today may be unpleasant tomorrow. Very same mind will reject something that it has accepted as being favorable just a short time ago. So in this way, the whole process is of the senses looking for objects around. This is nice, that is not nice. This is nice, that is not nice. Each of our senses is seeking something nice. And in the search for something nice, we also come upon something that is not nice. So all the time, the five senses are engaged in this search, 24 hours. And the only time we give it some rest is when we sleep. But even then, even in our sleep, there is one state. It is not that we immediately go into deep sleep. There are three primary states of consciousness that we are all aware of. One is called Jagran or Jagriti, the state of wakefulness in which we are all now, hopefully. And in this state, one is aware of the external world. The senses are very active. The senses are in touch with the objects of the senses. And gradually when the senses become tired, they need some rest. The body lies down. And then the active senses, the Jnanendriyas, the Karmendriyas become inactive. And we go into a state of sleep. But although the gross body, that is the Jnanendriyas and the Karmendriyas have become inactive, the mind is still active. The mind is running here and there. And that is called the dream state, swapan. In the swapna state, the mind is very active and it is so powerful that sometimes it forces the gross body to be active again, even in sleep, isn't it? If sometimes you have had a very bad dream, you may have woken up sweating or perspiring a lot, isn't it? Or you may have seen or heard of people who shout in their sleep or who talk in their sleep. There are also people who walk in their sleep. So all these things are possible because even though the senses have become inactive, the mind is so active and restless that it may force the senses to act even in sleep. And many times those who walk in their sleep, they do not know what they have been doing when they wake up. So that is the state of swapna, jagrati, swapna. And finally even the mind gets tired and the mind also needs some rest. And then we reach the state of deep sleep that is called sushupti. It is that state which is a real restful sleep that we get. Sometimes you may have an experience, you wake up in the morning feeling very tired. You are not feeling fresh as you should be after your night sleep. And then you may recall sometimes, yeah, I had so many dreams in the night. So when you have many dreams, then your sleep cannot be very peaceful or restful. Because of that, one feels very tired. If we have even a short time of sushupti, good quality of sleep, and the mind shuts itself up, then one feels very restful. So the question now arises, when one is in sushupti, if even the mind is not active, then how does one come to the state of wakefulness again? Neither the gross body is active nor the subtle body is active. Both are totally at sleep. So how do we wake up again? Can anyone answer? No, every day. Every day when you sleep, by the Paramatma in the heart, the Lord in the heart, Ishvara Sarva Bhutanam Hriddeshe Arjuna Tishtati Brahmayan Sarva Bhutanam Yantra Arudhani Mayaya. Then the Lord in the heart is our alarm clock. He wakes up the mind. Yes, come on, time to wake up. Sometimes because of light, sometimes because of sound. It is because of Paramatma in the heart, he wakes up. Even though the gross body and the subtle body are practically speaking inactive, but there is one substance within the body that is always there, conscious. What is that? The soul. The soul is always there. It remains as it is, unchanged, whether it's in the jagrati state, the swapna state, or the sushupti state. It remains ever a witness. And it is because the soul is present in the body that one can return from the state of deep sleep of sushupti to the state of jagrati. In this way, the cycle goes on. One who is situated on a spiritual platform, totally self-realized, he comes to another state of consciousness, a fourth state of consciousness, which is higher than the first three. And that is called Turiya or Samadhi, where he understands himself totally to be the soul and not the body. He is beyond bodily consciousness. This is called the Brahma Bhuta state. Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma na shochati na kaankshati samaha sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktin labhate param. When one has understood oneself to be the soul, one has realized one's distinctive nature separate from the body, then one becomes very joyful. One becomes kind, well-wishing friend of all living beings. One does not hanker for anything. One does not lament over anything. And in this state, one can actually achieve pure bhakti for the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna. So it is in this state of consciousness that all these activities in this shloka today have been described. But anyway, coming back to the point, we have all these karmendriyas and gyanendriyas which are acting. And all through the day they are seeking engagement with the sense objects. So the sense objects are called the tanmatras, which the senses are seeking. So what are the five tanmatras or the sense objects? What does the eye seek? Form. So form is the first sense object. What do the ears seek? Sound. So sound is a second sense object. What does the tongue seek? Taste. So taste is a third sense object. What does the skin seek? Touch. So touch is a fourth sense object. And the nose? Smell. So smell is a fifth sense object. So these five things we are always seeking in this world. Every living being, from the ant to the human being, is seeking to gratify its bodily senses through these five sense objects. Each sense is respectively engaged in seeking gratification in that particular tanmatra or sense object. And this is the way the world is going on. So that makes 23. And there is a 24th element which is called pradhana. This is a slightly technical thing, we will not go into it. Pradhan, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, is the origin of the whole material universe. When the material universe is destroyed, it goes back to its unmanifested or avyakta state. And everything is dismantled. All these 23 elements are dismantled. They don't remain in that form. And they go back into a very primeval state. And that is called pradhana. When the time for creation of the universe comes again, this pradhana is then again transformed at various stages by various actions of the Lord. And then all these 23 elements are formed again. So the 24th element is pradhana. So the whole material world comprises these 24 elements. But there is also a 25th factor in this world that is very important if anything is to go on, and that is time, kala. Kalosmi, Lord Krishna says, I am time. Loka krit kshaya pravriddhaha, I am all devouring time. I am here to destroy all the worlds. So time is the factor that acts in this material world to destroy everything. Time brings about death of every living being. Time brings about decay, brings about destruction. It is the agent for change in this world. So time acts upon these 24 elements. But even time and the 24 elements are not sufficient. A 26th element is required, which we discussed earlier. What is that? The soul, spirit, that is required. So when the spirit spark, the spirit soul is there, and the 24 elements of material creation are there, the time factor is there, and God is there to sanction everything, then the whole material world goes on. This is, in brief, the Sankhya philosophy, the Sankhya understanding, the analysis of this material world. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second and third cantos, very detailed analysis of this is given. And also in the teachings of Lord Kapila, this is described very wonderfully for those of you who wish to learn more about this. So in any case, the point is that these five jnanindriyas are always seeking the five tanmatra, sense objects, and that is what the world is all about. That's all. Everything that is going on here is simply this one phenomenon taking place. The senses seeking their objects. Bas. So now you will notice, what role has the Atma got to play in this? The Atma is not involved. The Atma has nothing to do, practically speaking, with either the senses or with the sense objects. The only role that the Atma plays is that if the Atma were not present in the body, the senses would not be able to seek out the sense objects. That's all. So it is because the Atma is present in the body that the senses become active. The eyes start looking here and there, the ears start looking for sound, and so on and so forth. So in this way, it is explained here in this verse that a person in the divine consciousness, even though he is engaged in so many activities, he understands that I am not doing it. It is only the senses interacting with their sense objects. And even when he is speaking, eating, walking, talking, he understands. The body is automatically doing its functions. The senses are automatically being engaged with the sense objects. But I have nothing to do with that. I, the soul, this is knowledge. In the third chapter of the Gita, Lord Krishna explains, Prakriti kriyamanani gunahi karmani sarvashah ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manyate. My dear Arjuna, Prakriti kriyamanani gunahi karmani sarvashah. It is actually Prakriti, through the three modes of material nature, sattva guna, rajaguna, tamaguna, that is actually acting and doing things in this world. But vimudhatma, a person who is bewildered, who is foolish, he thinks that I am the doer. Karta aham iti manyate. He thinks that I am the doer because of false ego. Ahankara vimudhatma. So false ego means the sense of bewilderment which makes a person think I am doing this. But actually, who is doing it? It is material nature. It is nature acting through the elements in the body and the senses that are actually performing all the actions. The Atma is only a silent observer. It is only the life-giving force sitting there in the body. The body will automatically do its job. The body, the material nature, will go on functioning. In fact, we see, let us take a different simple example to illustrate this point further. Let's take the act of eating. Try to analyze how the eating process takes place. And we will see how the 24 elements are playing a role in this process. First of all, some activity takes place in the stomach. The body needs food. So the Pancha Mahabhutas, especially the Jataragni, the fire, that starts getting activated. You start feeling hunger. The pangs of hunger, it go upon the other nerves and it impinges on the brain and you get some signal saying, yes, I want something, I want food. The desire comes in the mind from experience. Yes, if I get that kind of food, I will be happy. So then that hunger is analyzed. The mind desires, yes, I want food. Then the intelligence, the mind passes it over to the intelligence department. Now, you better seek out some food for me. I want food, you get me food. So the intelligence starts acting. Where is food? So intelligence goes to where the food is available, whether on the dining table or in the kitchen or in the hotel or anywhere. But the intelligence and the mind just sitting there, can they obtain the food? You have to go somewhere, isn't it, to get the food. So then, the mind has to instruct the senses. It instructs the karmendriyas. Now, my dear legs, please get up. Then the legs will move and you will move towards that place. Or you will speak, I want food, I am hungry, please serve me the food. Then your voice will act, that karmendriya will act. So all the gyanendriyas, the karmendriyas, they are acting now. Mind is acting, intelligence is acting. False ego is also acting. What is this, 10 minutes late? No food so far. False ego is also playing its role. Then you sit there. And having sat there, then also so many things are involved. You have to move your hands. You have to use your intelligence. You have to put your hand on the food. Pick up the food. Only as much as will go in your mouth. See, we think we take these little actions for granted. But just imagine how much intelligence and what is going on in the system just to do these ordinary actions. Nowadays there is a field in science called artificial intelligence, where they are trying to make robots and other things that simulate the behavior of a human being. So this robot, machine in the form of a human being, he will walk and he will talk and he will sit and stand and so many things. And they are finding it so difficult. They need so complex computers to do basic functions like moving the fingers, holding a pen. These are actually very, very complex phenomena when you analyze it at the minute level. But we are doing it naturally and spontaneously without a second thought. So then the mind is the intelligence again, deciding, yes, I have to just take so much food from my plate, not more, not less. Then the fingers act, everything has to be in coordination. Then the muscles have to be instructed, you press this hard, If you press loose, the food will fall down from the fingers. You have to press it hard enough, lift it, and not put in the ears, you have to put here. So it has to be coordinated. Such a complex thing. Every action of ours is extremely intricate and complex. Finally, we put it in the mouth, and automatically the teeth will start, then the instruction has to be given to the teeth. Some things will happen spontaneously. The enzymes, the ptyalin, and so many other things in the mouth will be generated to prepare the food for digestion in the stomach and the intestines. But consciously you have to start chewing. So the instruction is going there. Then you start tasting. And if the taste is very nice, then you are inspired to chew. If it is very bad, you spit it out. Oh, very bad. Then it goes down through the gullet, the alimentary canal. It progresses down the throat. Automatic actions take place. The Pancha Mahabhuta are acting in their own way under the instructions of various organs of the body. It goes into the stomach. Again, the digestion starts taking place there. We don't know how it is taking place, but it goes on. And then finally, when all the nutrients are assimilated into the body, then there is evacuation, which also takes place on its own accord. The karmendriyas, gyanendriyas are acting. In this way, you see the complex interaction of all these 24 elements is taking place. And the time factor is also involved here. And the soul is not doing anything. It is just the senses who are acting. The karmendriyas, gyanendriyas, sense objects, they are all interacting with each other, engaging with each other. And that is how this is going on. So in this way, you can analyze every action that we do in life, not just eating, but sleeping, walking, talking. So a self-realized soul understands that actually speaking, I have nothing to do with this material body. And it is simply the senses engaged with the sense objects. They are going on their own. So to illustrate this with an example, let us discuss briefly in 5 minutes the case of Prahlad. This is very nicely explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, we will not discuss the whole story of Prahlad. We will only discuss that brief section that deals with his spiritual advancement so far as it refers and is relevant to this verse of today. Hiranyakashipu, the very powerful asura, had 4 sons, of which Prahlad was the best, the most exalted. He was a great devotee of the Lord, although he was born in an asura family. There are 2 classes of people in this world, sura and asura. Sura are those who are devotees of the Lord. Asuras are those who are opposed to the devotional service of the Lord. So Hiranyakashipu was the champion or the leader of the asuras, but his son became a great devotee. He had all the wonderful characteristics that can ever adorn a human being. He was cultured, he was well-mannered, well-behaved, his senses and mind were absolutely controlled. He was very kind to everyone, very compassionate. He was a friend to everyone. He did not discriminate against anyone. He was free from envy towards devotees and towards anyone. He was free from anger. And all the time he was striving to understand spiritual things, the absolute truth. He saw all his fellow beings with sympathy, treated them like his own brothers. He was a servant to all respectable people. He was like a father to the poor. He treated all his gurus and teachers like God. He was completely free of pride. And many, many other qualities which Shukadev Goswami describes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, this narration about Prahlad is being made by Narad Muni to Yudhishthir Maharaj. And Narad Muni tells Yudhishthir that even though Prahlad was born in a family of asuras, and the asuras are natural enemies of the devas or the asura or the suras, still, even in satsangas that take place in the devaloka, when all the devatas gather together to have spiritual discussions, the moment you talk of an exalted devotee of the Lord, the name of Prahlad is always the first to be mentioned. In any spiritual gathering, my dear Yudhishthir, Narad tells Yudhishthir, Prahlad's name is mentioned. So just imagine what a great devotee he was. Narad Muni goes on to explain, Krishna graha grihitatma. So Krishna was like a graha, like a planet that was influencing him, grihitatma. We see that sometimes if somebody is influenced by a malevolent planet like Shani, Rahu or Ketu, then somehow nothing works in his life. In exactly the opposite way, the Krishna graha was acting on Prahlad, and nothing material could be ever of any concern to him. He was totally absorbed in Krishna consciousness, 24 hours absorbed in the thoughts of the Lord. Nothing else ever captivated his mind or his attention. And because of his deep devotion to the Lord, all the good qualities manifested in him. Yasyasti bhakti bhagavati akinchana sarvair gunais tatra samasate sura harava bhaktasya kuto mahatguna manurathe nasati dhavato bahi. The Srimad Bhagavatam explains that when one actually becomes a devotee of the Lord, all the good qualities of the devas manifest in that person. But if one is not a devotee of the Lord, then whatever good qualities may be there are of no avail, because under the influence of the three modes of material nature, everything will ultimately be destroyed. So Prahlad, because of his deep devotion for the Lord, had all these wonderful qualities that he manifested. Even as a child, he was never interested in childish playthings. Now, you may have noticed that it is practically impossible for a small child to stay with playing. A small child by its nature is always very playful, but Prahlad was never so. He was always absorbed in thoughts of Lord Krishna. And it is described that sometimes his behavior could not be understood by people in general. Sometimes he would suddenly laugh, sometimes he would suddenly cry, sometimes he would suddenly jump and shout, sometimes he would sit silent, sometimes he would shout up and down, and people would not understand, and then tears would be flowing from his eyes. And all this was simply because he was sometimes experiencing separation from Lord Krishna, and sometimes he was feeling the physical presence of Lord Krishna. Srila Prabhupada gives a very beautiful analogy for this, and that is of a small child who is in the lap of the mother. If the mother leaves the child on the floor and goes away to perform some family duty, then the child becomes very morose and starts crying. And if the child cries very hard, then the mother comes back. And when the mother comes back and holds the child again, the child becomes jubilant and starts laughing. In the same way, Prahlad would sometimes feel separation from the and sometimes, and when Lord Krishna would see that, he would come to him. And Prahlad was seeing all this from his spiritual senses. Others could not see all this happening. And when he would see Lord Krishna coming close towards him, he would suddenly become jubilant and start laughing. But others could not understand why he is laughing, why he is crying. We see that when the mother comes from a long distance, if the child has been crying very bitterly, then the mother from a long distance will say, I'm coming, do not cry. Then the child gets little pacified. So similarly, when he felt separation from Lord Krishna and he would start crying, sometimes he would see Lord Krishna far away in the distance, coming from Vaikuntha, all the way coming. And it was as if Krishna was saying, I'm coming, don't worry. And then Prahlad would feel satisfied. And then sometimes he would feel the hand of the Lord on his head. And at such times, tears would be flowing from his eyes. Tears of love and happiness would flow. In this way, Prahlad did not know how the world is functioning. He had no idea how the world is going on around him. He was so absorbed in Krishna consciousness, even at that age. And then Narad Muni describes to
to Yudhishthir Maharaj, Asinah Paryatan Nashnan Shayanah Pratibandhavan Nanusandhatta Etani Govinda Parirambhitaha. He says, Prahlad did not know, no anusandhatta etani. He did not know how he was performing actions like asinah, like eating, or sitting, I beg your pardon. Paryatan means walking, ashnan means eating, shayanah means sleeping, prapiban means drinking, bhuvan means speaking. Prahlad did not know how these actions were going on. Automatically they were being performed. Govinda parirambhitaha, because he was being embraced by Lord Govinda, Lord Krishna. Again, Prabhupada explains that just as a small child who is in the lap of its mother does not know how its bodily activities of eating, sleeping, passing water, evacuating are going on, he is simply secure under the shelter and love of his mother. Similarly, Prahlad also did not know how he is eating, sleeping, walking, what he is doing. He was simply under the shelter of Lord Krishna. This is a beautiful example and analogy by which we can understand this verse. 8 and 9 verses from this 5th chapter. Being completely absorbed there, the mother takes care of the child. Even if the child is feeling hungry, she will feed the child. She will clothe the child. The child is not concerned with anything. Similarly, Prahlad was not concerned with anything. He did not know how the body was acting, how the senses were engaged with the sense objects. In this way, a self-realized person understands that I am not the doer. It is material nature that is acting. The senses are engaged with the sense objects. And therefore, a devotee like Prahlad, performing actions, even though engaging his senses in the objects of this world, does so only for the pleasure and the service of Lord Krishna and not for the purpose of sense gratification. That is the difference between a devotee's actions and a non-devotee's actions. A non-devotee engages his senses for Krishna's joy. Sarva padhi vinir muktam hrishikena hrishikesha sevanam bhaktir uchyate. This is bhakti. The senses are called hrishika. Isha means controller. So the controller of our senses is Hrishikesha. So when a devotee engages all his senses in the service of Hrishikesh, Hrishikena Hrishikesha Sevanam, that is called bhakti. So if we also engage our senses in the devotional service of the Lord, we can also be very active in this world, perform a variety of duties and activities, but still we will remain aloof from the functioning of the body, which will go on automatic nature, and we can retain our consciousness on the divine platform and eventually attain the perfection of life, which is pure love for the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna. So thank you. Krishna Hare Hare, Amma Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. So we will have some darshan and bhajans for some time, and then there will be questions and answers after that.
Matter. When the soul leaves the body, then everything is over. But then each cell, someone told me that each cell of the body is functioning individually and each cell has a soul. So the entire body has got millions and zillions of souls, and there's one soul which is dominating over all the other souls, which I call it as me. So then if that soul, which I call as me, leaves the body, then is it that automatically all the other souls that are situated in the cells and all that, they also automatically leave?
As you know, when we say that a person is dead, no part of his body can survive indefinitely. No part can continue to act independently. It has no capacity to move or to perform the functions that it was earlier doing. So we should know that basically it is the presence of the individual soul, the you or the I or the me, that is really responsible for
for life or consciousness within. Even the cells in the body can function only so long as that cell, the soul is there in the body. Otherwise, those cells also cannot function. There are varieties of cells in the body, and all these cells can do their function only when the Atma is present in the body, which is located in the region of the heart.
Is it true that each individual cell has a soul in it?
Each individual cell is not an independent living entity. So we are not to consider that as a living entity with a soul. Each cell is dependent on the main soul in the body for its existence and functioning. It does not have an independent existence.
Hare Krishna, it is said that jnanis cannot live together. It is said that jnanis cannot live together because they have difference of opinions. So if they stay together, then they will, it is ultimately that they will continue arguing, that jnanis. So they cannot stay together. They have to secretly go into a forest, each jnani. But it is not the case with the devotees. Devotees come together because they are like mentality. But still we can see that in this Kali Yuga, even though many devotees come, they have still the difference of opinions in terms of their likings. So, and moreover, this false ego also comes up, which do not allow integrity to be there. So, how can devotees maintain that integrity?
There are two different things. One is ego, and the other is individuality. Being a devotee of God doesn't mean that we give up our individuality. You will like mango juice, I may like orange juice. Both of us may be devotees, but individuality will remain. Your likes and dislikes may remain, but the devotee's likes and dislikes are all connected and utilized in the service of Lord Krishna. That is the point. There is a common central point where all the activities of the senses are engaged as far as the devotee is concerned. Now, if a devotee is not totally pure, to that extent the remnants of the false ego will be there, because after all, even the devotional path is not a path where perfection can be attained overnight. It takes long years of endeavor, and it is a process of gradual purification. So there will be traces and remnants of ego and other anarthas like greed, lust, pride, and so on. So progressively, as the devotee performs his devotional service, then all these things will begin to disappear. And till such time as one reaches the perfection on the devotional path, these anarthas may sometimes cause problems. Is discriminating, intelligent, and sincere to what the anarthas are, and it is the anarthas that are acting at this time, and he pulls them out by the root and understands that these are weeds that are acting and impeding the growth of his devotional creeper, then harmony with others. If, however, the devotee is not cautious to recognize and pull out by the roots these unwanted things as they manifest in his heart, then he will begin to exhibit behavior that is not as it should be for a devotee. So, like in every other path of learning, it takes time to learn one's lessons, and we make progress gradually learning from mistakes. Therefore it says, Mahajano yena gataha sapantha. One learns by following in the footsteps of great acharyas. That is why we hear about stories about great devotees like Prahlad and so on. Why? So we can understand what the ideal state is and try to follow in their footsteps. For example, Prahlad, what was his behavior towards other people? How did he relate to enemies, so-called enemies? How did he relate to friends? How did he relate to elders? How did he relate to the poor? How did he relate to variety of people? We only discuss briefly now. So we can also understand what is the behavior of an ideal devotee. So because it is a practical world, it is not an ideal world we are living in, so we are not surrounded also by ideal people, and we ourselves are not ideal, but we strive for the ideal.
And if a devotee is very sincere, he may commit mistakes, but he will learn because he is introspective, he is observing within his own heart, his own feelings, and rectifying them. And in this way, if devotees are sincere by nature, then there will be no problem. So it is a sincerity, intelligence, discrimination that can create harmony and integration. In fact, if at all there is any hope of integration, as you say, amongst the devotees or amongst people or human beings in this world, it is only amongst devotees. Otherwise, it is next to impossible to have any degree of integration amongst people who have different interests, or rather who each have their self-interest at heart. When there are so many different centers of existence, there cannot be any integration. Each will be in a different direction. But because devotees have that common goal of serving one person, therefore there is possibility, at least theoretically, of integration. If devotees do their job well, if devotees are sincere on the path and they follow the process properly without negligence. Any other question? Krishna.
Prabhuji, you describe now the distinction between mind and soul. And you said that soul is not taking any part in the activities of other indriyas, what they are doing, and only mind is giving, mind is supreme as far as giving orders to the other indriyas for activities, and soul has got nothing to do with activities. According to me, what I understood, the soul is directly or indirectly influencing on mind, means giving chetana to mind. Without that chetana, mind will not work. So how we can say that mind is soul is not taking part as far as human body's activities are concerned? So will you please remove this illusion from my mind? Thank you.
As we discussed, it is not that the soul has no role to play in the body. Rather, it has the most crucial role to play, in the sense that without the presence of the soul, none of the indriyas can act. In fact, the body will just be lifeless without any action. But the point is, the role of the soul is only to impart consciousness to the body. And once the consciousness is imparted, then the indriyas are playing their own role. The indriyas, the mind, the manah, buddhi, ahankar, everything is playing its own role. And in that playing of the role, and the interaction between them and between the sense objects, the soul has no role to play. The only function the soul is performing is to impart that consciousness to the body by its very presence, that's all. Otherwise, the soul is not doing anything. It is just the soul being present within the body, illumining the gates of the body with consciousness. But the activities of the senses, the engagements of the senses with the sense objects, are taking place according to the laws of material nature, according to the three gunas. And it is a mind that is being influenced by the three gunas. We did mention that the eye wants to see something beautiful, the ear wants to hear something melodious. Now the three gunas will act in different ways and make different people see, want to see or hear different things. So one person will want to hear some disco music or film music, which he thinks is very melodious, because he is influenced by a particular guna, influenced by sattva guna. He also wants to hear something melodious, but he will rather hear bhajans of the Lord, or he will try to hear some soft classical music. Similarly with all the other indriyas. In other words, we can see that all this is going on according to the dictation of the laws which are directing the senses to be engaged in the sense objects, which are presenting the sense objects as allurements for the senses. And according to the guna that is predominantly influencing that particular personality, then the senses will be engaged in those kinds of sense objects, whether in sattva-guna, raja-guna, tamo-guna. So therefore the soul is a passive observer. The soul is not engaged actively. The soul is only sitting there in the region of the heart, in the body. And because it is simply sitting there, its natural property which is spreading all over the body. And because that consciousness is there, it activates the senses, the mind, neural nature, makes them work. So therefore, we understand that the soul, although present in the body, and although the senses cannot act without the soul, but the soul is not playing any role in the functioning and the activities of the senses in engagement with their sense objects. Is that all right? One last question, if there is any.
Fourth element.
Yes.
Mentioned as pradana.
Yes.
So it is made out of the other 23 elements.
No, the pradhan is a source of the other 23 elements.
So it is actually an undifferentiated energy.
That's right.
Can,
yes.
Convert into anything in the universe.
Yes.
Or it is made out of pradhan.
Yes.
Now my question is to know whether is that what we are referring to God, or is there God separate?
That is a nice question. That pradhan is not God. That pradhan is still material. Because all these 24 elements that we mentioned are all material. These are the 24 elements of material creation, of material nature. Whereas God is spiritual. God is the source and origin of even the pradhana. Pradhan is the origin of the universe and all the elements of the universe, all the 23 other elements, and it is He who activates the pradhana. Just like you may have some ingredients in a kitchen. Simply by having a gas stove, a vessel, water and ingredients, it is not sufficient. You need someone to put it all together and to stir it. So like that, God makes the ingredients, He keeps them there, and at the appropriate time, when the time is right for the creation to commence again, that is of the universe, then He activates it. He lets loose His time energy, He lets loose His glance upon the pradhana, and gradually transformations start taking place. The various 23 elements start becoming created, then they interact with each other, and in this way the entire material universe is created. It's a seed of the material universe, of the material energy, which is avyakta, undifferentiated, unmanifest. And that is also coming from God. God is a supreme spiritual being. He resides beyond the pradhana, in the spiritual realm where everything is spiritual. And this material creation, whereas the spiritual world of God is the parashakti, the superior energy, the superior world. We are presently caught in this material energy, the aparashakti, and our duty is to go back even beyond the pradhana, back to the spiritual world where the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna is residing. Is that all right? So we will stop here now. Mahaprasade Govinda.